The beer flowed until after 11, when Sam turned off the projector and dismissed them with the usual promise of a rough practice on Wednesday. Rick and Trey hung around, and when all the Italians had left, they opened another bottle with Sam. Mr. Brunkarter was reluctant to bring in another running back, Sam said.
Why?
Trey asked. Not sure, but I think it's money. He's really upset with the loss yesterday. If we can't compete for the Super Bowl, why burn any more cash? This is not exactly a moneymaker for him anyway.
Why does he do it? Rick asked.
Excellent question. They have some funny tax laws here in Italy, and he gets big write-offs for owning a sports team. Otherwise, it would not make sense.
The answer is Fabrizio, Rick said. Forget him. I'm serious. With Trey and Fabrizio, we have two great receivers. No team in the league can afford two Americans in the secondary, so they can't cover us. We don't need a tailback. Franco can grunt out 50 yards a game and keep the defense honest. With Trey and Fabrizio, we play pitch and catch for 400 yards.
I'm tired of that kid, Sam said, and Fabrizio was no longer discussed. Later, in a pub, Rick and Trey raised a glass to Sly and cursed him at the same time. Though neither would admit it, they were homesick and envied Sly for calling it quits. Tuesday afternoon, Rick and Trey, along with Alberto, the dutiful understudy, met Sam at the field and for 3 hours worked on precision routes, timing, hand signals, and a general overhaul of the offense. Nino arrived late for the party. Sam informed him they were switching to a shotgun formation for the rest of the season, and he worked frantically on his snaps. With time, they improved to the point that Rick wasn't chasing them around the backfield. Wednesday night, in full pads, Rick spread the receivers, Trey and Claudio, and began firing passes everywhere. Slants, hooks, posts, curls. Every pattern worked. He threw to Claudio often enough to keep the defense honest, and every 10th play he stuck the ball in Franco's gut for a little violence at the line. Trey was unstoppable. After an hour of sprinting up and down the field, he needed a break. The offense, almost shut out by a weak Milan team 3 days earlier, now seemed capable of scoring at will. The team rallied from its slumber and came alive. Nino began trash-talking the defense, and he and Pietro were soon cussing back and forth. Someone threw a punch, a quick brawl ensued, and when Sam broke it up, he was the happiest guy in Parma. He saw what every coach wanted, emotion, fire, and anger. He made them quit at 10:30. The locker room was chaos. The air was full of dirty socks, dirty jokes, insults, threats of stealing girlfriends. Things were back to normal. The Panthers were ready for war. The call came on Sam's cell. The man identified himself as a lawyer and had something to do with athletics and marketing. He spoke rapid Italian, and over the phone it sounded even more urgent. Sam often survived by reading lips and hand gestures. The lawyer finally got to the point. He represented Fabrizio, and Sam at first thought the kid was in trouble. Not hardly. The lawyer was also a sports agent, with many soccer and basketball players on his roster, and he wanted to negotiate a contract for his client. Sam's jaw dropped an inch or two. Agents? Here in Italy?
There goes the game.
That son of a bitch walked off the field in the middle of a game, Sam said in the rough Italian equivalent.
He was upset. He's sorry. It's obvious you can't win without him.
Sam bit his tongue, counted to five.
Keep cool, he told himself.
A contract meant money, something no Italian Panther had ever sought. There were rumors that some of the Italians in Bergamo got paid, but it was unheard of in the rest of the league.
Play along, Sam thought.
What kind of contract do you have in mind? He asked, rather businesslike.
He's a great player, you know. Probably the best Italian ever. Don't you think? I value him at 2,000 euros a month.
2,000, Sam repeated. Then the usual agent's trick.
And we are talking to other teams.
Good. Keep talking. We're not interested.
He might consider less, but not much.
The answer is no, pal. And tell the kid to stay away from our field. He might get a leg broke. Charlie Cray of the Cleveland Post slithered into Parma late Saturday afternoon. One of his many readers had stumbled across the Panthers' website and was intrigued by the news that the greatest goat on Cray's list was hiding in Italy. The story was simply too good to ignore. Sunday, Cray got in a cab at his hotel and tried to explain where he wanted to go.
The driver was not familiar with football Americano and had no idea where the field was. Great, thought Cray. The cabbies can't even find the field. The story was growing richer by the hour. He finally arrived at Stadio Lanfranchi 30 minutes before kickoff. He counted 145 people in the stands, 40 Panthers in black and silver, 36 Warriors in white and blue, one black face on each team. At kickoff, he estimated the crowd at 850. Late that night, he finished his story and zipped it around the world to Cleveland, in plenty of time for the Monday morning sports special. He could not remember having so much fun. It read, Big Cheese in the Pizza League, Parma, Italy. In his miserable NFL career, Rick Dockery completed 16 passes for 241 yards, and that was with six different teams over 4 years. Today, playing for the Panthers of Parma in Italy's version of the NFL, Dockery exceeded those numbers. In the first half, 21 completions, 275 yards, 4 touchdowns, and, the most unbelievable stat of all, no interceptions. Is this the same quarterback who single-handedly threw away the AFC title game? The same no-name signed by the Browns late last season for reasons still unknown, and now considered the greatest GOAT in the history of pro football? Yes, this is Senior Dockery, and on this lovely spring day in the Po Valley, he was simply masterful, throwing beautiful spirals, standing bravely in the pocket, reading the defense, word used loosely, and believe it or not, scrambling for yardage when necessary. Rick Dockery has finally found his game. He's the man, playing with a bunch of overgrown boys. Before a noisy crowd of fewer than 1,000 and on a rugby pitch 90 yards long, the Panthers of Parma hosted the Warriors of Bologna. Either team would be a 20-point underdog against Slippery Rock, but who cares? Under Italian rules, each team can have up to 3 Americans. Dockery's favorite receiver today was Trey Colby, a rather thin young man who once played at Ole Miss and could not, under any defensive scheme, manage to get himself covered by the Bologna secondary. Colby ran wild and free. He caught 3 touchdowns in the first 10 minutes. The other Panthers are rowdy young men who picked up the sport as a hobby later in life. Not a single one could start for a Class 5A high school in Ohio. They are white, slow, small, and play football because they can't play soccer or rugby. By the way, rugby, basketball, volleyball, swimming, motorbiking, and cycling all rank far above football Americano in this part of the world. But the Warriors were no pushovers. Their quarterback played at Rhodes. Where? Memphis, D3. And their tailback once carried the ball 58 times in 3 years for Rutgers. Ray Montrose is his name, and today he ran for 200 yards and 3 touchdowns, including the game winner with a minute to go. That's right, even here in Parma, Dockery can't escape the ghosts of his past. Up 27-7 at halftime, he once again managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. But, in all fairness, it wasn't entirely his fault. On the first play of the second half, Trey Colby went high for an errant pass, surprise, surprise, and landed badly. He was hauled off the field with a compound fracture somewhere in his lower left leg. The offense sputtered, and Mr. Montrose began marching up and down the field. The Warriors put together a dramatic drive as time ran out and won 35-34. Rick Dockery and his Panthers have lost their last 2, and with only 5 games remaining, their chances of making the playoffs look slim. There is an Italian Super Bowl in July, and evidently the Panthers thought Dockery could get them there. They should have asked Browns fans. We would tell them to ditch this bum now and find a real quarterback, one from a junior college. And quick, before Dockery starts firing passes to the other team. We know what this gunslinger can really do. Poor Parma Panthers. Chapter 18. Rick and Sam waited like expectant fathers at the end of a hallway on the second floor of the hospital. It was 11:30 Sunday night, and Trey had been in surgery since just after 8 p.m. The play was a 30-yard pass at midfield, near the Panthers' bench. Sam heard the crack of the fibula. Rick did not. He did, however, see the blood in the bone fragment protruding through the sock. They said little as they killed time by reading magazines. Sam was of the opinion that they could still qualify for the playoffs if they won the remaining 5 games. A tough chore, since Bergamo lay ahead. And Bolzano was strong again. They had just lost to Bergamo by 2 points. But winning seemed unlikely with so little offense left, and with no American in the secondary to stifle the passing game. It was more pleasant to ignore football and stare at magazines. A nurse called them and led them to the third floor, to a semi-private room where Trey was being arranged for the night. His left leg was covered in a massive plaster cast. Tubes ran from his arm and nose.
"He'll sleep all night," another nurse said.
She went on to explain that the doctor had said everything had gone fine. No complications, a fairly routine compound fracture. She found a blanket and a pillow, and Rick settled into a vinyl chair next to the bed. Sam promised to hustle back early Monday morning to check on things. A curtain was pulled, and Rick was left alone with the last Black Panther, a very sweet country kid from rural Mississippi who would now be shipped home to his mother like broken merchandise. Trey's right leg was uncovered, and Rick studied it. The ankle was very thin, much too thin to withstand the violence of SEC football. He was too skinny and had trouble keeping his weight up, though he had been voted third-team all-conference his senior year at Ole Miss. What would he do now? What was Sly doing now? What would any of them do once they faced the reality that the game was over? The nurse eased in around one and turned down the lights. She handed Rick a small blue pill and said,
"To sleep."
20 minutes later, he was knocked out as cold as Trey. Sam brought coffee and croissants. They found two chairs in the hall and huddled over their breakfast. Trey had made some racket an hour earlier, enough to arouse the nurses. "Just had a quick meeting with Mr. Bruncardo," Sam was saying. "He likes to start the week with a 7 o'clock ass-chewing on Monday morning." "And today's your day." "Evidently. He doesn't make any money off the Panthers, but he certainly doesn't like to lose money either, or games. A rather substantial ego."
"That's rare for an owner."
"He had a bad day. His minor league soccer team lost, his volleyball team lost, and his beloved Panthers, with a real NFL quarterback, lost for the second time in a row. Plus, I think he's losing money on every team."
"Maybe he needs to stick to real estate, or whatever else he does."
"I didn't give him any advice. He wants to know about the rest of our season, and he says he's not spending any more money."
"It's very simple, Sam," Rick said, placing his coffee cup on the floor. "In the first half yesterday, we scored 4 touchdowns with no sweat.
Why?"
"Because I had a receiver. With my arm and a good set of hands, we are unstoppable, and we won't lose again. I guarantee we can score 40 points every game. Hell, every half."
"Your receiver is in there with a broken leg."
"True. Get Fabrizio. The kid is great. He's faster than Trey and has better hands."
"He wants money. He has an agent."
"A what?"
"You heard me. Got a call last week from some slimy lawyer here who says he represents the fabulous Fabrizio, and they want a contract."
"Football agents here in Italy?"
"Afraid so." Rick scratched his unshaven face and pondered this disheartening news.
"Has any Italian ever received money?"
"Rumor says some of the Bergamo boys are paid, but I'm not sure."
"How much does he want?"
€2,000 a month.
"How much will he take?"
"Don't know. We didn't get that far."
"Let's negotiate, Sam. Without him, we're dead."
"Bruncardo ain't spending more money, Rick. Listen to me. I suggested we haul in another American player, and he went through the roof."
"Take it out of my salary."
"Don't be stupid.
I'm serious. I'll chip in €1,000 a month for 4 months to get Fabrizio."
Sam sipped his coffee with a frown and studied the floor.
"He walked off the field in Milan." "Sure he did. He's a brat. Okay, we all know that. But you and I are about to walk off the field 5 more times with our tails tucked if we don't find someone who can catch a football. And Sam, he can't walk off if he's under contract."
"Don't bet on it."
"Pay him, and I'll bet he acts like a pro. I'll spend hours with him, and we'll be so finely tuned, no one can stop us. You get Fabrizio, and we won't lose again. I guarantee it."
A nurse nodded in their direction, and they hurried in to see Trey. He was awake and very uncomfortable. He tried to smile and crack a joke, but he needed medication. Arnie called late Monday afternoon. After a brief discussion of the merits of arena football, he moved on to the real reason for the call. He hated to pass along bad news, he said, but Rick should know about it. "Check out the Cleveland Post online, Monday sports section. Pretty ugly stuff." Rick read it, let fly the appropriate expletives, then went for a long walk through the center of Old Parma, a town he suddenly appreciated like never before.
How many low points can one career have? 3 months after he fled Cleveland, it was still eating his carcass.
Judge Franco handled matters for the team. The negotiations took place at a sidewalk cafe along the edge of Piazza Garibaldi, with Rick and Sam seated nearby having a beer and dying of curiosity. The judge and Fabrizio's agent ordered coffee. Franco knew the agent and didn't like him at all. 2,000 euros was out of the question, Franco explained. Many of the Americans don't earn that much, and it was a dangerous precedent to start paying the Italians because, obviously, the team barely broke even anyway. More payroll, and they might as well close shop. Franco offered 500 euros for 3 months, April, May, and June. If the team advanced to the Super Bowl in July, then a 1,000 euro bonus. The agent smiled politely while dismissing the offer as much too low. Fabrizio was a great player, and so on. Sam and Rick nursed their beers but couldn't hear a word. The Italians haggled back and forth in animated conversation, each seemingly shocked at the other's position, then both snickering over some minor point. The negotiations seemed to be polite but tense. Then suddenly there was a handshake, and Franco snapped his fingers at the waiter. Bring 2 glasses of champagne. Fabrizio would play for 800 euros a month. Signor Brancato appreciated Rick's offer to help with the contract, but he declined it. He was a man of his word, and he would not downsize a player's salary. By practice time Wednesday night, the team knew the details of Fabrizio's return. To quell resentment, Sam arranged for Nino, Franco, and Pietro to meet with their star receiver beforehand and explain a few matters. Nino handled most of the discussion and promised, with no small amount of detail, to break bones if Fabrizio pulled another stunt and abandoned the team. Fabrizio happily agreed to everything, including the broken bones. There would be no problems. He was very excited about playing again and would do anything for his beloved Panthers. Franco then addressed the team in the locker room before practice and confirmed the rumors. Fabrizio was indeed getting paid. This didn't sit well with most of the Panthers, though no one voiced disapproval. A few were indifferent. If the kid can get some money, why not? It will take time, Sam said to Rick. Winning changes everything. If we win the Super Bowl, they'll worship Fabrizio. Sheets of paper had been quietly passed around the locker room. Rick had hoped the poison from Charlie Cray might somehow remain in the United States, but he was wrong, thanks to the internet. The story had been seen and copied and was now being read by his teammates. At Rick's request, Sam addressed the matter and told the team to ignore it. Just the sloppy work of a sleazy American reporter looking for a headline. But it was unsettling for the players. They loved football and played the game for fun, so why should they be ridiculed? Most, though, were more concerned about their quarterback. It was unfair to run him out of the league and out of the country, but to follow him to Parma seemed especially cruel. I'm sorry, Rick, Pietro said as they filed out of the locker room. Of the two teams in Rome, the Lazio Marines were usually the weaker. They had lost their first 3 games by an average of 20 points and had shown little spunk in doing so. The Panthers were hungry for a win, and so the 5-hour bus ride south was not unpleasant at all. It was the last Sunday in April, overcast and cool, perfect for a football game. The field, somewhere in the vast outskirts of the ancient city, miles and centuries away from the Colosseum and other splendid ruins, gave little evidence of being used for anything other than practice in the rain. The turf was thin and patchy, with hard sections of gray dirt. The yard lines had been striped by someone either drunk or crippled. 2 sections of crooked bleachers held maybe 200 fans. Fabrizio earned his April salary in the first quarter. Lazio had not seen him on tape, had no idea who he was, and by the time they scrambled their secondary, he had caught 3 long passes, and the Panthers were up, 21-0. With such a lead, Sam began blitzing on every play, and the Marines' offense crumbled. Their quarterback, an Italian, felt the pressure before each snap. Working solely from the shotgun and with superb protection, Rick read the coverage, called Fabrizio's route by hand signals, then settled comfortably into the pocket and waited for the kid to jiggle and juke and pop wide open. It was target practice. By halftime, the Panthers were up 38-0, and life was suddenly good again. They laughed and played in the tiny locker room and completely ignored Sam when he tried to complain about something. By the fourth quarter, Alberto was running the offense, and Franco was thundering down the field. All 40 players got their uniforms caked with dirt. On the bus back home, they resumed their verbal assaults on the Bergamo Lions. As the beer flowed and the drinking songs grew louder, the mighty Panthers were downright cocky in their predictions of their first Super Bowl. Charlie Cray had been in the bleachers, sitting among the Lazio faithful,
watching his second game of football Americano. His coverage of last week's game against Bologna had been so well received in Cleveland that his editor asked him to stay on for a week and do it again. Tough work, but someone had to do it. He'd spent 5 wonderful days in Rome at the paper's expense, and now he needed to justify his little vacation with another takedown of his favorite goat. His story read, "More Roman Ruins. Rome, Italy." Behind the surprisingly accurate arm of Rick Dockery, the ferocious Panthers of Parma rallied from a 2-game losing streak and stomped the living daylights out of the winless Marines of Lazio here today in another crucial matchup in Italy's version of the NFL. The final, 62-12. Playing on what appeared to be a reclaimed gravel pit and before 261 non-paying fans, the Panthers and Dockery racked up almost 400 yards of passing in the first half alone. Skillfully picking apart a defensive secondary that was slow, confused, and thoroughly afraid to hit, Mr. Dockery strutted his stuff with his rifle arm and the marvelous moves of a gifted receiver, Fabrizio Benozzi. At least twice Mr. Benozzi faked so deftly that the deep safety lost a shoe. Such is the level of play here in NFL Italy. By the third quarter, Mr. Benozzi appeared to be exhausted from scoring so many long touchdowns, 6 to be exact, and the great Dockery appeared to have a sore arm from throwing so much. Browns fans will be astonished to learn that, for the second week in a row, Dockery failed to throw the ball to the other team. Amazing, isn't it? But I swear, I saw it all. With the win, the Panthers are back in the hunt for the Italian championship. Not that anyone here in Italy really cares. Browns fans can only thank God that such leagues exist. They allow riffraff like Rick Dockery to play the game far away from where it matters. Why, oh why, didn't Dockery discover this league a year ago? I almost weep when I ponder this painful question. Ciao. Chapter 19. The bus rolled into the parking lot at Stadio Lanfranchi a few minutes after 3 on Monday morning. Most of the players were due at work in a few hours. Sam yelled to wake up everyone, then dismissed the team with a week off. Next weekend was a bye. They stumbled off the bus, unpacked their gear, and headed home. Rick gave a ride to Alberto, then drove through downtown Parma without seeing another car. He parked at a curb, 3 blocks from his apartment. 12 hours later, he awoke to the buzzing of his cell phone. It was Arnie, abrupt as always. "Deja vu, pal. Have you seen the Cleveland Post?"
"No. Thank God we don't get it over here."
"Go online, check it out. That worm was in Rome yesterday."
"No."
"Afraid so."
"Another story?"
"Oh yes, and just as nasty." Rick rubbed his hair and tried to remember the crowd at Lazio. A very small crowd, scattered throughout some old bleachers. No, he didn't take the time to study faces. And anyway, he had no idea what Charlie Cray looked like.
"Okay, I'll read it."
"Sorry, Rick. This is really uncalled for. If I thought it would help, I'd call the paper and raise hell, but they're having way too much fun. It's best to ignore it."
"If he shows up in Parma again, I'll break his neck. I'm in tight with the judge."
"Attaboy. Later." Rick found a diet soda, took a quick cool shower, then turned on his computer. 20 minutes later, he was zipping through traffic in his Punto, shifting effortlessly, smoothly, like a real Italian. Trey's apartment was just south of the center, on the second floor of a semi-modern building designed to cram a lot of people into as few square meters as possible. Trey was on the sofa with his leg propped up on pillows. The small den resembled a landfill, dirty dishes, empty pizza cartons, a few beer and soda cans. The TV was running old Wheel of Fortune shows, and a stereo in the bedroom was playing old Motown.
"Brought you a sandwich," Rick said, placing a bag on the cluttered coffee table.
Trey waved the remote, and the TV went mute.
"Thanks."
"How's the leg?"
"Great," he said with a hard frown.
A nurse stopped by 3 times a day to tend to his needs and bring the painkillers. He had been very uncomfortable and complained about the pain.
"How'd we do?"
"Easy game. Beat him by 50 points. Rick settled himself into a chair and tried to ignore the debris.
"So you didn't miss me?"
"Lazio is not very good." The easy smile and carefree attitude were gone, replaced by a sour mood and a truckload of self-pity. That's what a compound fracture will do to a young athlete. The career,
however Trey defined it, was over, and the next phase of life was beginning. Like most young athletes, Trey had given little thought to the next step. When you're 26 years old, you'll play forever.
"Is the nurse taking care of you?"
Rick asked.
"She's good. I get a new cast Wednesday and leave Thursday. I need to get home. I'm going crazy here."
They watched the silent TV screen for a long time. Rick had stopped by daily since Trey left the hospital, and the tiny apartment was growing smaller. Maybe it was the trash piling up, or the unwashed laundry, or the windows closed tight and covered. Maybe it was just Trey sinking further into his gloominess. Rick was happy to hear he would be leaving so soon.
"I never got hurt on defense," Trey said, staring at the TV. "I'm a defensive back, never got hurt. Then you put me on offense, and here I am."
He tapped the cast hard for dramatic effect.
"You're blaming me for your injury? I never got hurt on defense."
"That's a bunch of crap. You're saying only offensive players get hurt?"
"I'm just talking about me."
Rick was bristling and ready to bark, but he took a breath, swallowed hard, looked at the cast, then let it pass. After a few minutes, he said,
"Let's go to Polipo's for pizza tonight?"
"No."
"Would you like for me to bring you a pizza?"
"No."
"A sandwich? A steak? Anything?"
"No."
And with that, Trey lifted the remote, punched a button, and a happy little housewife purchased a vowel. Rick eased from the chair and quietly left the apartment. He sat in the late afternoon sunshine at an outdoor table and drank a Peroni from a frosty mug. He puffed on a Cuban cigar and watched the ladies walk by. He felt very alone and wondered what on earth he might do for an entire week to keep himself occupied. Arnie called again, this time with some excitement in his voice.
"The rat is back," he announced triumphantly. "Got hired yesterday by Saskatchewan head coach. First call he made was to me. He wants you, Rick, right now."
"Saskatchewan?
You got it. $80,000.
"I thought Rat hung it up years ago."
"He did. Moved to a farm in Kentucky, shoveled horse shit for a few years, got bored. Saskatchewan fired everybody last week, and they've coaxed Rat out of retirement."
Rat Mullins had been hired by more pro teams than Rick. 20 years earlier, he had created a wacky machine gun offense that passed on every play and sent waves of receivers racing in all directions. He became notorious for a spell, but over the years fell out of favor when his teams couldn't win. He had been the offensive coordinator for Toronto when Rick played there, and the two had been close. If Rat had been the head coach, Rick would have started every game and thrown 50 times.
"Saskatchewan,"
Rick mumbled as he flashed back to the city of Regina and the vast wheat plains around it.
"How far is that from Cleveland?"
1,000,000 miles. I'll buy you an atlas. Look, they draw 50,000 a game, Rick. It's great football, and they're offering $80,000 right now."
"I don't know," Rick said.
"Don't be silly, kid. I'll have it up to 100 by the time you get here."
"I can't just walk away, Arnie. Come on."
"Of course you can."
"No."
"Yes. It's a no-brainer. This is your comeback. It starts right now."
"I have a contract here, Arnie."
"Listen to me, kid. Think about your career. You're 28 years old, and this opportunity won't come again. Rat wants you in the pocket with that great arm of yours firing bullets all over Canada. It's beautiful."
Rick chugged his beer and wiped his mouth. Arnie was on a roll.
"Pack your bags, drive to the train station, park the car, leave the keys on the seat, and say adios. What are they going to do, sue you?"
"That's not right."
"Think about yourself, Rick."
"I am."
"I'll call you in 2 hours.
Rick was watching television when Arnie called again.
"They're at $90,000, kid, and they need an answer."
"Has it stopped snowing in Saskatchewan?"
"Sure, it's beautiful. First games in 6 weeks. The mighty Rough Riders played for the Grey Cup last year, remember? Great organization, and they're ready to roll, pal. Rat's standing on his head to get you there."
"Let me sleep on it."
"You're thinking too much, kid. This ain't complicated."
"Let me sleep on it."
Chapter 20. Sleep, though, was impossible. He rambled through the night, watched television, tried to read, and tried to shake the numbing guilt that consumed any thought of running away. It would be so easy, and could be done in such a way that he would never be forced to face Sam and Franco and Nino and all the rest. He could flee at dawn and never look back. At least,
That's what he told himself. At 8 a.m., he drove to the train station, parked the Fiat, and walked inside. He waited an hour for his train. 3 hours later, he arrived in Florence. A cab took him to the Hotel Savoy, overlooking the Piazza della Repubblica. He checked in, left his bag in the room, and found a table outside at one of the many cafes around the bustling piazza. He punched the number for Gabriella's cell, got a recording in Italian, but decided not to leave a message. Halfway through lunch, he called her again. She seemed reasonably pleased to hear his voice, a little surprised maybe. A few stutters here and there, but she warmed up considerably as they chatted. She was at work, though she didn't explain what she was doing. He suggested they meet for a drink at Gili's, a popular cafe across from his hotel, and, according to his guidebook, a great place for a late afternoon drink. Sure, she eventually said, at 5 p.m. He drifted along the streets around the piazza, flowing with the crowd, admiring the ancient buildings. At the Duomo, he was almost crushed by a mob of Japanese tourists. He heard English, and lots of it, all coming from packs of what appeared to be American college students, almost all of whom were female. He browsed the shops on the Ponte Vecchio, the ancient bridge over the Arno River. More English, more college girls. When Arnie called, he was having an espresso and studying his guidebook at a cafe at the Piazza della Signoria, near the Uffizi, where mobs of tourists waited to see the world's greatest collection of paintings. He had decided he would not tell Arnie where he was.
"Sleep well?" Arnie began. "Like a baby. It's not going to work, Arnie. I'm not walking out in the middle of the season. Maybe next year."
"There won't be a next year, kid. It's now or never."
"There's always next year."
"Not for you. Rat'll find another quarterback, don't you understand?"
"I understand better than you, Arnie. I've made this circuit."
"Don't be stupid, Rick. Trust me on this."
"What about loyalty?"
"Loyalty? When was the last time a team was loyal to you, kid? You've been cut so many times."
"Careful, Arnie."
A pause, then, "Rick, if you don't take this deal, then you can find another agent."
"I was expecting that."
"Come on, kid. Listen to me."
Rick was napping in his room when his agent called again. An answer of no was only a temporary setback for Arnie.
"Got him up to 100 grand, okay? I'm working my ass off here, Rick, and I'm getting nothing from your end. Nothing."
"Thanks."
"Don't mention it. Here's the deal. The team will buy you a ticket to fly over and meet with Rat. Today, tomorrow, soon, okay? Real soon. Will you please do this just for me?"
"I don't know."
"You got a week off. Please, Rick, as a favor for me. God knows I deserve it."
"Let me think about it."
He slowly closed the phone while Arnie was still talking. A few minutes before 5, he found a table outside of Gili's, ordered Campari on the rocks, and tried not to look at every female who crossed the piazza. Yes, he admitted to himself, he was quite nervous, but also excited. He had not seen Gabriella in 2 weeks, nor had he spoken with her on the phone. No emails, no contact whatsoever. This little rendezvous would determine the future of the relationship, if indeed there was a future. It could be a warm reunion with one drink leading to another, or it could be stiff and awkward and the final dose of reality. A small pack of college girls descended on a table close by. They all talked at once, half on cell phones, the others rattling on at full volume. Americans, accents from the South, 8 of them. 6 blondes. Jeans mainly, but a couple of very short skirts. Tanned legs. Not a single textbook or notebook among them. They slid 2 tables together, pulled chairs, arranged bags, hung jackets, and in the flurry of properly settling in, all 8 managed to keep talking. Rick thought about moving, but then changed his mind. Most of the girls were cute, and the English was comforting, even if it came in torrents. From somewhere inside Gili's, a waiter pulled the short straw and ventured forth to take their orders, primarily wine, with none of the requests in Italian. One spotted Rick, then 3 more glanced over. 2 lit cigarettes. For the moment, no cell phones were in use. It was now 5:10. 10 minutes later, he called Gabriella's cell and listened to the recording. The Southern Belles were discussing, among other things, Rick and whether he was Italian or American. Could he even understand them? They really didn't care. He ordered another Campari, and this, according to one of the brunettes, was clear evidence that he was not an American. They suddenly dropped him when someone mentioned a shoe sale at Ferragamo. 5:30 came and went, and Rick was beginning to worry. Surely she would call if there was a delay, but maybe she wouldn't if she decided not to meet him. One of the brunettes in one of the miniskirts appeared at his table and quickly fell into the chair across from him.
"Hello," she said with a dimpled smile. "Can you settle a bet?"
She glanced at her friends, and so did Rick. They were watching with curiosity. Before he could say anything, she continued,
"Are you waiting on a man or a woman? It's half and half at our table. The losers buy the drinks."
"And your name is?"
"Livy. Yours?"
"Rick."
And for a millisecond, he was terrified of using his last name. These were Americans here. Would they recognize the name of the greatest goat in the history of the NFL?
"What makes you think I'm waiting on anyone?" Rick asked.
"It's pretty obvious. You glance at your watch, dial a number, don't say anything, watch the crowd, check the time again. You're definitely waiting on someone. It's just a silly bet. Pick one, male or female."
"Texas?"
"Close. Georgia."
She was really cute. Soft blue eyes, high cheekbones, silky dark hair that fell almost to her shoulders.
He wanted to talk.
"A tourist?"
"Exchange student. And you?"
Interesting question, with a complicated answer.
"Just business," he said.
Quickly bored, most of her friends were talking again. Something about a new disco where the French boys hung out.
"What do you think? Man or woman?" he asked.
"Maybe your wife?"
Her elbows were on the table and she was leaning closer, thoroughly enjoying the conversation.
"Never had one."
"Didn't think so. I'd say you're waiting on a woman. It's after business hours. You don't look like the corporate type. You're definitely not gay."
"That obvious, huh?"
"Oh, definitely."
If he admitted he was waiting on a woman, then he might look like a loser who was being stiffed. If he said he was waiting on a man, then he would look stupid when and if Gabriella arrived.
"I'm not waiting on anyone," he said.
She smiled because she knew the truth.
"I doubt that."
"So where do American college girls hang out in Florence?"
"We have our places."
"I might be bored later."
"Care to join us?"
"Certainly."
"There's a club called..."
She paused and looked at her friends, who had moved on to the urgent matter of another round of drinks. Instinctively, Livy decided not to share.
"Give me your cell number, and I'll call you later after we make some plans."
They swapped numbers. She said,
"Ciao,"
and returned to her table, where she announced to the pack that there were no winners, no losers. Rick over there was waiting on no one. After waiting for 45 minutes, he paid for his drinks, winked at Livy, and got lost in the crowd. One more phone call to Gabriella, one final effort, and when he heard the recording, he cursed and slapped the phone shut. An hour later, he was watching TV in his room when his phone rang. It wasn't Arnie. It wasn't Gabriella.
"The girl didn't show, did she?"
Livy began cheerily.
"No, she didn't."
"So you're all alone?"
"Very much."
"Such a waste. I'm thinking about dinner. You need a date?"
"Indeed I do."
They met at Pauli's, a short walk from his hotel. It's an ancient place with one long dining hall under a vaulted ceiling covered with medieval frescoes. It was packed, and Livy happily confessed that she had pulled strings to get a table. It was a small one, and they sat very close together. They sipped white wine and worked through the preliminaries. She was a junior at the University of Georgia, finishing her last semester abroad, majoring in art history, not studying too hard, and not missing home. There was a boy at Georgia, but he was a temp, disposable. Rick swore he had no wife, no fiancé, no steady relationship. The girl who didn't show was an opera singer, which of course changed the direction of the conversation considerably. They ordered salads, pappardelle with rabbit, and a bottle of Chianti. After a hearty pull of wine, he gritted his teeth and addressed the issue of football head-on. The good, college. The bad, the nomadic pro-career. And the ugly, his brief appearance last January for the Cleveland Browns.
"I haven't missed football," she said,
and Rick wanted to hug her. She explained that she had been in Florence since September. She did not know who won the SEC or national title and really didn't care. Nor did she have any interest in pro football. She had been a cheerleader in high school and had endured enough football to last a lifetime. Finally, a cheerleader in Italy. He briefly described Parma, its Panthers, the Italian League, then moved the topics back to her side of the table.
"There seem to be a lot of Americans here in Florence," he said.
She rolled her eyes as if she was fed up with Americans.
"I couldn't wait to study abroad, dreamed about it for years, and now I'm living with three of my sorority sisters from Georgia, none of whom has any interest in learning the language or absorbing the culture. It's all shopping and discos. There are thousands of Americans here, and they stick together like geese."
She might as well be in Atlanta. She often traveled alone to see the countryside and to get away from her friends. Her father was a noted surgeon who was having an affair that was causing a protracted divorce. Things were messy back home, and she was not excited about leaving Florence when the semester ended in 3 weeks.
"Sorry," she said when she wrapped up the family summary.
"No problem."
"I'd like to spend the summer traveling in Italy, away finally from my sorority, away from the frat boys who get drunk every night, and very far away from my family."
"Why not?"
"Daddy's paying the bills. Daddy says to come home."
He had no plans beyond the season, which might stretch into July. For some reason, he mentioned Canada, maybe to impress her. If he played there, the season would go into November. This did not make an impression. The waiter delivered heaping plates of pappardelle and rabbit, a rich meat sauce that looked and smelled divine. They talked about Italian food and wine, about Italians in general, about the places she had already visited and the ones on her wish list. They ate slowly, like everyone at Paoli's, and when they finished with the cheese and port, it was after 11.
"I don't really want to go to a club," she admitted. "I'll be happy to show you a couple, but I'm not in the mood. We go out so often."
"What's on your mind?"
"Gelato."
They walked across the Ponte Vecchio and found an ice cream shop that offered 50 flavors. Then he walked her to her apartment and kissed her goodnight. Chapter 21.
"It's 5 o'clock in the morning here," Rat began pleasantly. "Why the hell am I wide awake and calling you at 5 in the morning? Why? Answer me that, blockhead."
"Hello, Rat," Rick said as he visually choked Arnie for giving away his phone number.
"You're a moron, you know that? A first-class idiot, but then we knew that 5 years ago, didn't we? How are you, Ricky?"
"I'm fine, Rat. And you?"
"Soper, off the charts, kicking ass already and the season hasn't started."
Rat Mullins talked in a high pitch at full throttle and seldom waited for a response before he launched into his next verbal assault. Rick had to smile. He had not heard the voice in years, and it brought back fond memories of one of the few coaches who had believed in him.
"We're gonna win, baby. We're gonna score 50 points a game. Other teams scores 40. I don't care, because they'll never catch us. Told the boss yesterday that we need a new scoreboard. Old one can't count fast enough for me, and my offense, and my great quarterback, Blockhead Dockery. Are you there, boy?"
"I'm listening, Rat, as always."
"So here's the deal. The boss has already bought a round-trip ticket. First class, you ass. Didn't spring one for me. Rode back in coach, leaving Rome in the morning at 8, non-stop to Toronto. Then to Regina. First class again. Air Canada, a great airline, by the way. We'll have a car at the airport when you touch down. And tomorrow night, we'll be having dinner and creating brand-new, never-before-heard-of pass routes."
"Not so fast, Rat."
I know. You can be very slow. How well I remember. But..."
"Look, Rat, I can't walk away from my team right now."
"Team? Did you say team? I've been reading about your team. The guy in Cleveland, what's his name? Cray. He's all over your ass. 1,000 fans for a home game. What is it, touch football?"
"I signed a contract, Rat."
"And I got another one for you to sign, a much bigger one, with a real team and a real league, with real stadiums that hold real fans. Television, endorsements, shoe contracts, marching bands, and cheerleaders."
"I'm happy here, Rat."
There was a pause as Rat caught his breath. Rick could see him in the locker room at halftime, pacing frantically and talking wildly as both hands thrashed the air, then a sudden stop for air as he sucked in mightily before launching into the next tirade. An octave lower, then trying to sound wounded, he began,
"Look, Ricky, don't do this to me. I'm sticking my neck out after what happened in Cleveland, well..."
"Drop it, Rat."
Okay, sorry. But will you just come see me? Come visit and let me talk to you face to face. Can't you do that for your old coach? No strings attached. The ticket's bought. No refund. Please, Ricky."
Rick closed his eyes, massaged his forehead, and reluctantly said,
"Okay, coach. Just a visit. No strings."
"You're not as dumb as I thought,"
I love you, Ricky. You won't be sorry.
Who picked the airport at Rome?
You're in Italy, right?
Yes, but...
That's where Rome is, last I checked. Now find the damn airport and come see me.
He knocked back 2 quick Bloody Marys before takeoff and managed to sleep for most of the 8-hour flight to Toronto. Landing anywhere in North America made him anxious, regardless of how ridiculous such thoughts were. Killing time as he waited for the flight to Regina, he called Arnie and reported his whereabouts. Arnie was very proud. Rick emailed his mother, but did not say where he was. He emailed Livy with a quick hello. He checked the Cleveland Post just to make sure Charlie Cray had moved on to other targets. There was a note from Gabriella.
Rick, I am so sorry, but it would not be wise to see you. Please forgive me.
He stared at the floor and decided not to reply to it. He called Trey's cell, but there was no answer. His 2 years in Toronto had not been unpleasant. It seemed so long ago, and he seemed so much younger back then. Fresh from college with big dreams and a long career ahead of him, he thought he was invincible. He was a work in progress, a greenhorn with all the tools. He just needed a little polish here and there, and before long he would start in the NFL. Rick wasn't sure if he still dreamed of playing in the big league. An announcement mentioned Regina. He walked to a monitor and realized his flight had been delayed. He inquired at the gate and was told the delay was weather-related. "It's snowing in Regina," the clerk said. He found a coffee bar and ordered a diet soda. He checked out Regina and, yes, there was snow, and lots of it. A rare spring blizzard was one description. Killing time, he browsed through the Regina Daily, the leader post. There was football news. Rat was making noise, hiring a defensive coordinator, evidently one with very little experience. He'd cut a tailback, leading to speculation that a running game would not be necessary. Season ticket sales had topped 35,000, a record. A columnist, the type who drags himself to the typewriter and manages to write 600 words 4 times a week for 30 years now, regardless of how absolutely dead the sports world happens to be in Saskatchewan or wherever, mailed in a gossipy potpourri of things heard on the street. A hockey player had said no to surgery until the season was over. Another had separated from his wife, who had a suspicious broken nose. Last paragraph. Rat Mullins confirmed that the Rough Riders were talking to Marcus Moon, a scrambling-style quarterback with a quick arm. Moon spent the past 2 seasons with the Packers and was anxious to play every day. And Rat Mullins refused to confirm or deny that the team was talking to Rick Dockery, who, when last seen, was throwing gorgeous interceptions for the Cleveland Browns. Rat was quoted as offering a gruff, "no comment," to the Dockery rumor. Then, with a wink, the sports writer passed along a little tidbit too rich to ignore. The use of parentheses gave him some distance from his own gossip. For more on Dockery, go to Charlie Cray at clevelandpost.com. No comment? Rat is too afraid or too ashamed to comment? Rick asked this question out loud and got a stare or two. He slowly closed his laptop and went for a long hike through the concourse. When he boarded an Air Canada commuter flight 2 hours later, he was headed not to Regina, but to Cleveland. There, he took a cab downtown. The Cleveland Post building was a bland, modern structure on Slate Avenue. Oddly, it was 4 blocks north of the community of Parma. Rick paid the cab driver and told him to wait around the corner, a block away. On the sidewalk, he paused only for a second to absorb the fact that he was really once again in Cleveland, Ohio. He could have made peace with the city, but the city was determined to torment him. If there was any hesitation about doing what he was about to do, he did not remember it later. In the front lobby, there was a bronze statue of some unrecognizable person with a pretentious quotation about truth and freedom. A guard station was just beyond it. All guests were required to sign in. Rick was wearing a Cleveland Indians baseball cap, purchased moments earlier at the airport for $32, and when the guard said, "Yes, sir," Rick was quick to respond, "Charlie Cray." "And your name?"
"Roy Grady. I play for the Indians."
This pleased the guard greatly, and he slid the clipboard over for a signature. Roy Grady, according to the Indians' website, was the newest member of the team's pitching staff. A youngster, just called up from AAA, who so far had pitched in 3 innings with very mixed results. Cray would probably recognize the name, but maybe not the face.
"Second floor," the guard said with a big smile.
Rick took the stairs because he planned to leave by them. The second-floor newsroom was what he expected, a vast open area crammed with cubicles and workstations and papers stacked everywhere. Around the edges were small offices, and Rick began to walk while looking for names by the doors. His heart was pounding, and he found it hard to appear nonchalant.
Roy!
Someone called from the side, and Rick stepped in his direction. He was about 45, balding, with a few long strands of oily gray hair sprouting from just over his ears. Unshaven, cheap reading glasses halfway down his nose, overweight, and with the body type that never earned a letter in high school, never got a uniform, never got the cheerleader. A disheveled sports geek who couldn't play the games, and now made a living criticizing those who did. He was standing in the door of his small, cluttered office, frowning at Roy Grady, suspicious of something.
Mr. Cray,
Rick said, 5 feet away and closing fast.
Yes,
he answered with a sneer, then a look of shock. Rick shoved him quickly back into the office and slammed the door. He yanked off his cap with his left hand as he took Cray's throat with his right. It's me, asshole. Rick Dockery, your favorite goat. Cray's eyes were wide. His glasses fell to the floor. There would be only one punch, Rick had decided, after much thought. A hard right to the head, one that Cray could clearly see coming. No cheap shots, kicks in the crotch, nothing like that. Face to face, man to man, flesh to flesh, without the aid of any weapon, and hopefully no broken bones and no blood. It wasn't a jab, and it wasn't a hook. Just a hard right cross that began months ago and was now being delivered from across the ocean. With no resistance, because Cray was too soft and too scared and spent too much time hiding behind his keyboard, the punch landed perfectly on the left chin bone with a nice crunch that Rick would pleasantly remember many times in the weeks afterward. He dropped like a bag of old potatoes, and for a second, Rick was tempted to kick him in the ribs. He had thought about what he might say, but nothing seemed to work. Threats wouldn't be taken seriously. Rick was stupid enough to show up in Cleveland. Surely he wouldn't do it again. Cursing Cray would only make him happier, and whatever Rick said would soon be in print. So he left him there, crumpled on the floor, gasping in horror, semi-conscious from the blow, and never, not for the slightest moment, did Rick feel sorry for the creep. He eased out of the office, nodded to a couple of reporters who looked remarkably similar to Mr. Cray, then found the stairs. He raced down to the basement, and after a few minutes of drifting, found a door to a loading dock. 5 minutes after the knockout, he was back in the cab. The return flight to Toronto was also on Air Canada, and when Rick landed on Canadian soil, he began to relax. Some 3 hours later, he was bound for Rome. Chapter 22. A heavy rainstorm settled over Parma late Sunday morning. The rain fell straight and hard, and the clouds looked as though they might be around for a week. Thunder finally woke Rick, and the first sight caught by his swollen eyes was red toenails. Not the red toenails of that last gal in Milan, nor the pink or orange or brown ones of countless, nameless others. No, sir. These were the meticulously manicured, not by the owner, and painted, Chanel Midnight Red, toenails of the elegant and sensual and quite naked Miss Livy Galloway of Savannah, Georgia, by way of the Alpha Chi Omega sorority house in Athens and, of late, a crowded apartment in Florence. Now she was in a slightly less crowded apartment in Parma, on the third floor of an old building on a quiet street, far from her suffocating roommates and very far away from her warring family. Rick closed his eyes and pulled her close under the sheets. She arrived late Thursday night on a train from Florence, and after a lovely dinner, they retired to his room for a long session in bed, their first. And though Rick had certainly been ready for it, Livy was just as eager. Originally, his plans for Friday had been to spend the day in bed or somewhere close to it. She, however, had radically different ideas. On the train, she had read a book on Parma. It was time to study the city's history. With a camera and her notes, they launched a tour of the city center, studiously inspecting the interiors of buildings Rick had hardly noticed in passing. The first was the Duomo. Rick had peeked inside once out of curiosity, where Livy took on a zen-like meditative state as she dragged him from corner to corner. He wasn't sure what she was thinking, but occasionally she offered helpful sentences such as, "It's one of the finest examples of Romanesque architecture in the Po Valley." "When was it built?" he always asked.
It was consecrated in 1106 by Pope Pasquale, then destroyed by an earthquake in 1117. They started again in 1130 and typically worked on it for 300 years or so. Magnificent, isn't it?
Truly.
He tried hard to sound engaged, but Rick had already learned that it didn't take long for him to examine a cathedral. Livy, however, was in another world. He tagged along, followed close, still thinking about their first night together, glancing occasionally at her fine rear end, and already planning an afternoon assault. In the center aisle, staring straight up, she said, "The dome was frescoed by Correggio in the 1520s. It depicts the Assumption of the Virgin. Breathtaking." Far above them in the vaulted ceiling, old Correggio had somehow managed to paint an extravagant scene of Mary surrounded by angels. Livy looked at it as if she might be overcome with emotion. Rick looked at it with an aching neck. They shuffled through the main nave, the crypt, the numerous bays, and they studied the tombs of ancient saints. After an hour, Rick was desperate for sunshine. Next was the baptistry, a handsome octagonal building near the Duomo, and they stood motionless for a long time before the north portal, the portal of the Virgin. Elaborate sculptures above the door portrayed events from the life of Mary. Livy checked her notes, but seemed to know the details.
"Have you stopped here?" she asked.
If he told the truth and answered no, then she would consider him a rube. If he lied and said yes, it wouldn't matter anyway, because Livy was about to inspect another building. In truth, he had passed it 100 times and knew that it was indeed a baptistry. He wasn't certain exactly what a baptistry was used for nowadays, but nonetheless, he pretended to. She was talking softly, almost to herself, as well she might have been.
4 tiers in red Verona marble, started in 1196, a transition between Romanesque and Gothic.
She took some photos of the exterior, then led him inside, where they gawked at another dome.
"Byzantine, 13th century," she was saying. "King David, the flight from Egypt, the 10 commandments.
He nodded along, his neck beginning to ache.
"Are you Catholic, Rick?" she asked.
"Lutheran. You?"
"Nothing, really. Family's some strain of Protestant. I dig this stuff, though, the history of Christianity and the origins of the early church. I love the art."
"There are plenty of old churches here," he said. "All Catholic."
"I know."
And she did. Before lunch, they toured the Renaissance Church of San Giovanni Evangelista, still in the religious center of the city, as well as the Church of San Francesco del Prato. According to Livy, it was one of the most remarkable examples of Franciscan Gothic architecture in Emilia. To Rick, the only interesting detail was the fact that the beautiful church had once been used as a jail. At 1, he insisted on lunch. They found a table at Sorel Picci on Strada Farini, and as he studied the menu, Livy made more notes. Over Anolini, the best in town in Rick's opinion, and a bottle of wine, they talked about Italy and the places she'd been. 8 months in Florence, she had visited 11 of the country's 20 regions, often traveling alone on weekends because her roommates were too lazy or apathetic or hungover. Her goal had been to see every region, but she was out of time. Exams were in 2 weeks, then her long holiday was over. Instead of a nap, they attacked the churches of San Pietro Apostolo and San Rocco, then wandered through the Parco Ducale. She took photos and notes and absorbed the history and art, while Rick gamely trudged on in a sleepwalk. He collapsed in the sunshine and warm grass of the park, with his head in her lap, while she studied a map of the city. When he awoke, he finally coaxed her back to his apartment for a proper nap. At Pilippo's Friday night after practice, Livy was the star attraction. Their quarterback had found a lovely American girl, a former cheerleader at that, and the Italian boys were anxious to impress her. They sang bawdy songs and drained pitchers of beer. The story of Rick's mad dash to Cleveland to punch out Charlie Cray had taken on legendary status. The spin, started by Sam and inadvertently aided by Rick and his refusal to talk about the episode, had stayed fairly close to the facts. The glaring omission was that Rick left Parma to explore another contract, one that would require him to abandon the Panthers in mid-season. But no one in Italy knew this, nor would they ever. The evil Charlie Cray had traveled to their Italy to write nasty things about their team and their quarterback. He had insulted them, and Rick tracked him down, at what appeared to be considerable expense, decked him, then hustled back to Parma, where he was safe. Damned right he was safe. Anybody coming after Rick on their turf would get hurt.
The fact that Rick was now a fugitive added a level of daring and romance that the Italians found irresistible. In a country where laws are flaunted and those who flaunt